From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on March 3rd in Detroit. Fox News was hosting a Republican presidential debate. Donald Trump reiterated his support for torture, saying, quote, "We should go for waterboarding, and we should go tougher than waterboarding," end quote. And when told the generals or members of the military could refuse his orders to torture, Trump said they would not resist. Well, Benjamin Lawrence and others in our community, and Ben, by the way, is Director of International and Global Studies at RIT, they've been noting that Donald Trump is the first avowedly pro-torture president in American history. And this afternoon, RIT is hosting a public conversation on the subject, a conversation with Marin Semidar, who's a refugee from Eritrea. Semidar is going to discuss what we can learn from people who have fled countries where torture is state policy. Well, this hour, we welcome a panel that maybe can talk about that subject, torture, but also really the broader conversation about life for refugees in Rochester. There's a great deal of heated rhetoric about refugees here and around the world. We'll discuss resettlement and what life is truly like for refugees in our community. And we're honored to have a packed studio with guests who can help us with this. Let me welcome them now. Benjamin Lawrence is a professor of international studies and director of international and global studies at the Rochester Institute of Technology. Benjamin, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also here is Marin Semidar. I mentioned Marin. He's a refugee from Eritrea. Marin, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Maung Thet Win. Maung is a Karen refugee from Burma. Maung, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Amy Jabril is an RIT student and refugee from Somalia. Amy, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And hello as well to Mike Kniff, who's the executive director of Rochester Refugee Resettlement Services. Mike, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Benjamin, I'll start with you just sort of an overview, as I think this hour we're going to be able to cover a broad range of subjects, not the least of which is the personal stories of the people in our studio. And I think it's important to put human faces on human beings instead of talking about subjects like this in very abstract terms. We'll also talk torture, and we'll talk about the what is coming up this afternoon at RIT. That is an event that starts at 3:30, runs till 5 o'clock, and that's at the Carlson Auditorium this afternoon?
That's right. It's cold. Let's bring back torture, or worse.
Okay, and Marin will be there, and we'll be hearing more about that later this hour. But broadly speaking, you know, you're someone who's very, very close to the refugee community here. Let me start with this question. Just how hyperbolized has the subject of refugees around the world and in our community as well become?
Well, I think it's become very histrionic, very agitated, and very detached from reality. Perhaps the best example for me from my experience this last year has been this constant reference to extreme vetting, that somehow the refugees that are going to be brought into the United States through the formal refugee resettlement program are going to be subjected to extreme vetting. The reality is all refugees who are admitted into the United States under the official refugee resettlement program are subjected to extreme vetting. It's rigorous. It goes on for many years. We have numbers of refugees who are resettled in the Rochester area, and if you talk to almost any of them, they will tell you that their refugee resettlement process can take 2, 3, 7, 10 years. There's one student who graduated from RIT a few years ago who lived in a camp for 10 years and interviewed 5 times over a period of 3 years before he was admitted to the United States. We already do a very vigorous, intensive process of vetting refugees. The United States has many refugees that have been resettled. Since 1975, 3 million people have been resettled through the formal refugee resettlement program. The United States is one of 25 or 27 countries that are part of the UN official refugee resettlement program. And we take the greatest number of refugees within that program. But as a population, as a country, we take a relatively small number. So consider, for example, that last year in Germany, they had 1.1 million new fresh asylum claims. We have currently 600,000 pending asylum claims. And those are people who have applied for asylum, spanning for the last 5, 10, sometimes longer numbers of years. So that gives you some sense of the volume of refugees. And annually, we receive somewhere between 80 and 130,000, depending on the year's intake.
I saw a conversation on social media yesterday with someone who I will not name, but I will just say someone who is a person who I've known for a good amount of years, intelligent person working in our community, And he chimes in with the comment about how people are scared because of all the crimes that refugees are committing. And I'm wondering if the fear that we heard in this last election, if the fear that we see sort of here, maybe and around the world, do you think most of it comes from misinformation?
It comes from bold-faced lies, along with misinformation. The reality is there is no data to support the contention that refugees commit more crimes than anybody else. There is simply no scientific, empirical data to make such fanciful, dangerous claims. So I find it very problematic. Unfortunately, yesterday there was a very horrific incident at Ohio State, and I'm sure there'll be individuals who will use that incident, just like the incident that took place in San Bernardino, to marshal forces and opinion about and against refugee resettlement. But the vast majority of refugees who have been here for decades, the process began, the formal program began in the 1970s, as I said, are living healthy, respectful American lives, and they've become American citizens. And some of our most treasured national heroes were first and foremost refugees. Albert Einstein, Madeleine Albright. These are people who contributed remarkable things to our country, and refugees do that. Refugees come, and they settle, and they become citizens. They become Americans. And our country is populated by people who are descended from immigrants. And all of us, in some way or another, whether we were born here or our ancestors were born here, we've had to move at some point. Our families have had to move at some point. Maybe it's not us, maybe it's not our grandparents, but at some point in the past, we've all had to move because of conflict or danger. And that's who refugees are. They're people who are forced to flee because of conflict and danger. They're not people who come looking for opportunities to commit crime.
Let me ask Mike Kniff to weigh in on not just this, but as the executive director of Rochester Refugee Resettlement Services. I recall reading a piece by a conservative writer in Slate magazine online named Raihan Salam, who argued that, well, maybe some of the fear and some of the rhetoric is hyperbolic, but what we should do and what countries around the world should do is make sure that if refugees are brought in and welcomed, that there must be ways to integrate them in terms of jobs, in terms of living situation. Otherwise, they're going to be sort of out of work in very difficult situations wherever they end up resettling. So give me a sense, Mike, for how our community does when it comes to resettlement services.
Well, our operation, as an example, is designed with the mission exactly as you said. We want to get refugees to become contributing members of our community. So we look for ways to make sure they're adequately housed to start with, that their kids are getting proper education, that every opportunity is offered to these folks to get some kind of employment. Obviously, there are going to be barriers. There's a language barrier. There's a cultural barrier there. These are challenges that we need to overcome. But there's also a real sense, at least from my experience with refugees, that these folks are thrilled to have the opportunity to take advantage of America as the land of opportunity. I had one gentleman from Morocco. I think he was an immigrant more than a refugee. But he says, even today, this is still the best country in the world to have the opportunity to succeed. And that's what I see with most of the people that we're dealing with. So we ardently look for opportunities to provide work for them. I think there's a lot of employers in the workforce who see refugees as a valuable type of employee. And so they want to take advantage of that. So it's a complicated process, that's for sure. But I think our goal is to work with each family that we deal with to make them have an opportunity to succeed.
Let's work through the individual stories to better understand our guests and their experience. Annie Jabril is an RIT student and a refugee from Somalia. And can you take us through a little bit of your journey, Annie?
Well, it all started in Somalia. My family fled because there was civil war there. And basically, there was nowhere for you to fend for yourself, to find food for your family. So the living standards was very poor. So we fled to Kakuma, which is a refugee camp in Kenya. It's right under Nairobi. And we lived there for several years. And through the United Nations process, we became refugees. And we went through several interviews. And then ultimately, we were resettled in East Lansing, Michigan. And we came there at the end of 2004. And my whole family, it was about like 8 of us that came together. And it was through, I believe, a Catholic Family Services that resettled us into the United States. And we were there for about a year. They provided housing. And for the younger children, they provided, like, we went to school. We were able to go to doctors. And basically, they teach you everything that's American, where you got to go, you got to get an annual checkup every year. You have to where you, to buy your foods, teaching English to adults, basically, so that we can get around, how to use public transportation. And then after that, we moved to Rochester, Minnesota, which has a lot of Somali populations there, and we had family there. So we were able to get better assistance where we knew people that could take us places, because then we wouldn't have to rely on public transportation, and we didn't know English, so it was hard for us to get around. And then after that, I moved with my dad in Greensboro, North Carolina, where I lived for until I finished high school, and I came up here for college. And I am able to go to school. I speak English very well now, and I also have a associate's degree in paralegal studies. So throughout the whole process of the refugee system, I am able to lead a better life that my family didn't think I'd be able to have if we were back home. And I have better opportunities in the U.S. now, and then I can use this to teach my children or go back home and help out in any way that I can.
You speak about the process of going from Somalia to Kenya.
Kakuma, yes.
And almost the way I would sort of, in very simple terms, describe a summer vacation. And I understand. I mean, it's been a number of years, but can you at least describe what you recall? How old were you when that was happening?
I was seven when I moved there.
And you were in Kenya for a couple of years?
Yes.
What was life like there at that time for you?
It was in Kakuma. It was very difficult because it's basically desert-like. And then we didn't, right now it's a lot different, but we didn't have electricity. Your kitchen was just right outside of your door, and you had a little stove where you have charcoal, and then that's how you make food. Our houses were just basically made out of woods and like mud. We had to go fetch water for ourselves. And then sometimes we would have desert storms, and it was really difficult to go outside or like basically do anything. As a child, you want to go play outside.
Sure.
But then sometimes it's just you can't go because it's too hot, or there's a storm coming, and then, you know, it's very dangerous for you to go out there. So
did you understand when you eventually made your way to the United States, did you understand what was happening pretty well at the time? Did your family explain?
I understood to a certain extent, but a lot of times the family members will shield you from like what difficulties
sure.
going on. But I understood that we didn't have enough money. I understood that this is not how children should grow up. This is not what life was supposed to be like. And with everything that your parents will tell you when back in the day, oh, we had jobs and we used to live in a better house, and now basically we just live outdoors. So that's a different way of life that you don't get used to at all. Like your whole living standards is taken apart, and then you actually get to know what a struggle is before you even know what adulthood is.
Benjamin?
So the Kakuma refugee camp is one of several in Kenya that is largely populated by Somali refugees, but also there are Eritrean refugees, and there are others from other countries, from Sudan, South Sudan. But it's important to remember that the conflict that's been going on in Somalia has been going for a very long time. If you remember all the way back to the last year of President George the First,
H.W. Bush, yeah.
And then it led into Clinton's very poorly planned intervention in Somalia. And the conflict that's been going on there has been going on for decades. So the people who are living in these camps, some of them have been living in these camps for decades. The Kenyan government is very intolerant. They would say, that, of course, they're very tolerant of this foreign presence in their country. But they're also very intolerant of the people who are living there for a very long time. And a lot of Somali refugees are subject to violence in these camps. There are marauding gangs. it's not a safe place to be. These are not facilities where people choose to resettle in safety. They're places of desperation. The most interesting book I've read recently about this is by Johnny Steinberg. It's called A Man of Good Hope. And he talks about this experience of being in these camps and how Kenyan soldiers torture people, beat them, bribe them, pick people up, throw them in prison, and then their families have to pay ransom to get them out, steal their documents, tear their documents up in front of them, all the difficulty they go to just to get UNHCR documents formally recognizing their refugee status, sometimes torn up in the front of their face, and then they have to begin the entire process again. So these camps, and this is, of course, the story in Kakuma, you could talk about refugee camps in Malaysia mm-hmm. for people who have fled Myanmar. You could talk about refugee camps in Egypt or Israel where they fled Eritrea. These are similar experiences. Camps are dangerous places. They're often better than the war zone that you might flee from, but they're really very vulnerable, dangerous places.
Annie, I heard from a couple of listeners yesterday afternoon when we sort of previewed this discussion who didn't want their names disclosed publicly but have family who work with refugees or have family members very close to people in the local refugee community. And they're nervous right now. They're worried. I had a note from a woman who said, I'm worried about my friend who's scared to walk down the street wearing a hijab right now. Mm. Are you experiencing anything different? Is this particular moment in American history different for you? How would you describe it for yourself?
I feel the same way, especially with some of my family members. They talk to us about this all the time, and they're like, is it, you know, okay for you to wear the hijab? Can you wear it a different way? Like, I wear the hijab exactly how I'm wearing it right now, or I can do it in a turban slot. It doesn't matter to me, but there are women who wear it all the time, and this is our identity, basically. And then for someone to look at that and see something different or be able to tell you to take it off, that's very hurtful, and that's what scares a lot of my family members and me sometimes too, because I feel like in America we have freedom, and freedom to be whoever you want to be, and when that is taken away from you, it's disheartening for you to feel threatened just by being yourself. Like, there was a woman who was burned in New York, and because she was wearing a hijab, there are women who get their hijabs pulled off of their heads, and that's the scariest part for a lot of family members of mine, and they would encourage us to be who we are, but at the same time, if we could take it off, sometimes we feel we'll be a lot safer, and that's what's really disheartening about this election year.
I think it's beautiful, by the way. I think it looks great.
Thank you.
And I'm curious to know also, given what you have gone through in your life, I can't relate to it. Certainly I can. I can't relate to the actual struggle just to survive. Do you have days where you think back to that? Is it sort of amazing to you, understanding your own personal journey and then some of the comforts that westernized life brings that sometimes we probably take for granted? Do you think back to those times?
Yes, I do. And there's certain, like, especially it was when I was in the seventh grade, and I took the EOGs with in North Carolina, it's like the end of grade test, and I did very well on it. And I was very surprised because back home I didn't go to school because we couldn't afford to send me to school. So whatever I learned was watching Tom and Jerry and things like that. So when I came to the U.S., I was very afraid that I wasn't going to perform at the same level as other students because they have better opportunities here. You guys go to elementary school and then you have, you know, better school systems than us. So when I came, I was really scared of that. But once I realized that I can do anything I set my mind to, and once I passed that grade, I was really excited. And sometimes I do look back and think, wow, like, my life would have been different if I didn't come here. Like, what would I have become if I stayed back home? Like, would I have the same way of thinking, or would I still have aspirations? Would I still have hope? Would I still have desires to be, you know, have goals and dreams and be able to accomplish them? I don't know what my future would have been like if I stayed back home, but now I am a lot more different, and I see things a lot differently than people that have been raised here because I have a different perspective.
Sure.
Because I appreciate more things than they take for granted. Because when you've always had something, you don't know what it's like to be without, then you don't really appreciate it a lot of times. So.
And Amy, before I turn to your co-panelists, can you just give me a sense for now, as best you can kind of frame it up for yourself, because no one knows exactly what's ahead, but what you think you'd like to do, especially in context with the way the world conversation about refugees is going on, do you feel comfortable here, or do you have aspirations about your future that may take you to other places? What do you think?
I think so in this election, I've seen a lot of people say, hey, if Donald Trump wins, I'm going to move away, or, you know, or they feel a lot of times that people are attacking them, and which sometimes they are. However, I feel like if you have an open conversation where you understand both sides, it's going to be a lot better for our country to grow. We have to have these discussions. If someone doesn't know, maybe they're fearful because they've never come across a refugee. They don't know what it's like to have a different lifestyle like that. They don't know. They just hearing things, and that's what they're making their decisions based on. So you have to be able to sit back and relax and say, hey, maybe this isn't how it is. Let me tell you about my story. Let me show you a different way. Let me introduce you to some people. You know, why don't you get involved in your community? So once we have that discussion, it will be a better country. So we have to come together. It's the people that need to come together. It's not what divides us, doesn't separate us. It should bring us closer. So I just have a lot of hope to work with people, especially I want to work with refugees in the future. And I want to make a positive change and a positive impact in just the world in general. And I don't plan on just leaving the United States because right now it's not in my favor, or people are afraid of me, or, you know, of refugees in general. I'm not someone that you should be fearful of. I'm just like anybody else. So.
You make this country better.
Thank you.
It's just great talking to Amy. It's Famatu Amy Jibril. She's a RIT student and a refugee from Somalia. We're talking about refugee resettlement this hour, and we're talking about refugee resettlement in the broader context of some of the hyperbole and heated rhetoric you hear about refugees around the world. This is a chance to hear about actual real-life experiences. And so that's Amy's story, which we could do a whole hour on. Mong, we could probably do a whole hour on your story. Mong Thet Win is a Karen refugee from Burma. And if you could take us through a little bit through your background, kind of the way Amy did, Mong.
Hello, my name is Mong. I came from Burma, was a reseller in Thailand refugee camp since 1995. And it was 21 years ago, my family's flee from Burma due to government is unfairness between a villager and the community member, and discriminate between religious and between ethnic city, and there's so many things that most of us known as, and why refugees, why my family leave Burma, because we don't have opportunity that we have in the either in the United States or either in the refugee camp. Things like education purposes, and the kids are growing up with no education, and spend their time in the farm, doing the farm, and doing working with day to day. And other thing was, people are growing up, they're not treated as equally to others, and by races, separation, by races, separation, by religious, and walk down the street there, and we're being looked down on. We're being looked down on by races, by religious, and then family, and also it's like civil war. It's really hard to find the job, really hard to survive in for day to day, because of, you know, during the civil war and everything between ethnic group, it's the army and the government army are coming in. They will talk. Government army came in. House to house, or either village to village, they will take whatever they desire to, food, women, anything that they desire to do. Look at it. Don't know the upper management, the army or either government group, known or not. They just the soldier were coming in, just take it, or either violence to the people, and a lot of time they see down the street they don't like a person, they will beat it up. So many people will decide to leave the country, who decided to leave the country before the government, before the UNHCR, before they set up the camp in borderland in Thailand, between border Thailand and Burma, and people will live and along the line and find a job and farm. That's what they came from background. Their backgrounds came from find a job at in the farm and working there for years and years, and then until the United Nations set up the camp and people were slowly moving to the camp and start their life again all over, with the kid will have a better chance to study, kid will have a better chance to people will have a better chance to find a job opportunity. And
Benjamin, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Yes. So I think it's really illustrative of the earlier thing I was talking about in terms of different reasons why people become refugees. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of people who are refugees today, and there are about 65 million people today in search of new homes. Now, those people are not all formally refugees, because to be a formal refugee, you have to have papers from the UNHCR. The vast majority of people that we describe as refugees are people who would like to be officially. So they're still waiting. They're the most vulnerable. But Hmong's story illustrates one very common pathway to refugee experience, which is you're part of an ethnic group or religious minority that the government doesn't recognize as part of your country. So the Hmong people have been living in what is today Myanmar, Burma, in the highlands with Thailand, and also China. They've been living there for hundreds, for thousands of years, farming. So have the Chin people, so have Rohingya people. But the government of Myanmar doesn't recognize those people as citizens, and it uses its army to physically force them out of their lands, to seize their lands, often to seize women and children
as
slaves.
Just as Hmong was saying. Yeah.
Right? And pushes them physically across the border into Thailand. A lot of refugee camps are located right on the border with the country that from which they've fled, making refugee camps in Kenya and Thailand very dangerous places. But he's also describing what we call statelessness. And statelessness is when you do not have a nationality. In the UN Declaration of Human Rights says that everyone has a right to a nationality. But there are some countries in the world where the government has a specific idea of who should be citizens and who should not be citizens. And in Myanmar, they don't recognize Hmong people as part of their national identity. They don't recognize Chin people as part of their national identity. They deny them citizenship. And so those people are, if they can get into a camp where they can get some sort of temporary protection, the UNHCR will grant them refugee status. And then as they are stateless, they are automatically high priority for resettlement. So many of the new resettled refugees that come to the Rochester area are actually people who were formerly determined to be stateless. That means the country where they were physically born or where their parents were born refuses to recognize them as a national subject, and they need our help.
Hmong, when you were in that state with your family, how long did you have to wait before coming here?
It's a long process that we've been through. And in the year of 2000, United States opened for many countries. We call it our third country opportunity that we can resettle. Either we can choose Australia, United States, and there's a couple of countries that accept the refugee from Thailand. So in 2000, my family started to apply. We had a family meeting and talk about it, which country was going to, and we chose the United States the best. Then we came to the United States. It took about 8 years to go through the process. First, we applied and went through first interview and family member missing. And we recruit the family member and go through a second interview again about a couple of years later on. It took about 6 years to get into a serious interview into with the human services, United Nations. And when it came to DHS, what was it called? Department of Human Service, Homeland Security, or Human Service, Homeland Security, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. And we came into interview with DHS. And then we got into process, enrolled into, came to the United States. And about a year, it took about a year to get here. And when it came to the United States, and Catholic Families Center get us into resale house, food stamp, and medical immunization process throughout the what the United States standard meet. Mm-hmm. And
extreme vetting enough for you, Benjamin?
Yeah, well, I mean, when people talk about extreme vetting, what sort of fantasy world are they living in? I mean, what more vetting can you do in an 8-year period? Hmong and other people around the table and others who are living here in Rochester have been interviewed 3, 4, 5 times by teams of people from first the UNHCR, then the Department of Homeland Security, then maybe members of the State Department who are locally resident in that country, part of the refugee program. So they go through numerous processes of documentation, background checks, interviews, fingerprinting, everything you can possibly imagine. And his story is 8 years. So I'm really not sure what extreme vetting could possibly entail. I have no idea what more could be done.
Hmong, before we turn to Marin Semedar as a refugee from Eritrea, because again, Benjamin, why don't we just do this once a month where we meet more people in our community? We should literally book
that.
A day a month.
I'd be happy to do that.
Before we leave today, we honestly need to do that because I'm already looking at the clock going, I want to hear more of these stories. Hmong, how is life in the United States? How has resettlement been and how are you doing?
I say fantastic.
Yeah.
I've seen and thing that I will never dream to see. I have lived in a house that I would never dream to live. I'm driving in a car where I'm never, you know, would never dream to have it. I'm having an education that I would never dream to have it. I work with the people I never will like expecting to work with, and fantastic. And my family and my brother sister had a opportunity to go to finish up college and get it up and turn on help the community, turn on help the family. And refugee the back home, and we had a fantastic time, very, very great.
Well, and what are your hopes now for the future?
Turn around and help my people back at home.
How will you do that? What do you expect to be doing in say 5 or 10 years?
I work with many organizations, refugee organizations, especially with Mike Kniff. I work with the Mike Kniff and others community member around here, and expecting you either a donation, donating money to the refugee back in the camp, or either donating money to education organization, medical, that supporting to, especially in the camp or either and where is the needed area. Back in Burma or either in Thailand, it doesn't matter. Any refugee camp that we need it and will go in to serve things and help it, money-wise, anything, any sources.
We're glad you're here. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Hmong Thet Nguyen is a Karen refugee from Burma. Let's get the only break of the hour. We're going to come back and talk to Marin Semedar, who is a refugee from Eritrea. And we continue the conversation not only on the experience of our panelists here, but Marin will tell us a little bit more about what we can expect. If you want to attend this afternoon, Benjamin Lawrence, you can, 3:30 to 5, that's correct?
That's correct.
Open to the public.
That's right.
What's coming up?
Well, we're going to be having a conversation about what torture entails, why torture is perpetrated, the involvement of the United States in torture, and the prohibitions on torture that exist both in U.S. and international law. And we're also going to talk about what would it mean to bring back torture. We've had an administration that on its second day in office explicitly banned forms of torture that were being perpetrated by the previous Bush administration illegally. And now we have an incoming administration that has promised to bring things such as waterboarding back. So we're going to talk about what would that be like? What does it mean to experience torture? How do people who have had that experience recover and get on with their lives? And what we as individuals can actually do actively to make sure that this never happens.
Starts at 3:30 this afternoon in the Carlson Auditorium at RIT. If you want to attend, open to the public. Let's get that break and come back and talk to Marin Semedar next. Coming up in our second hour, you hear the term implicit bias quite often. What is it exactly? And maybe more importantly, how do we try to recognize it in ourselves if the very definition of implicit bias is the kind of bias we can't really see, we can't really detect in ourselves. We'll talk about prejudice, how it impacts others, and how we can try to recognize it in ourselves. That's next time. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Maren Semedar is a refugee from Eritrea. And Maren, you've heard your fellow panelists tell their stories. I'd ask you just to kind of take us through your own journey first.
All right. Thank you, Evan. Well, I'll start by saying a bit about my country and how we get to be to where we are today.
Sure.
A country that every family has paid lives in trying to get its independence. We had fought 30 years of war against two consecutive Ethiopian military leaders. One was backed by the British and the U.S., famous known Emperor Haile Selassie, and then followed by another colonel, which was highly supported by the Russians, Colonel Mengistu. Then after 30 years of war, we got independence in 1991. And I was born in the liberated Eritrea among the Eritrean soldiers. So those are my parents included. And then we were very grateful, looking forward to a great nation. And the country was making great progress until 1997, which a constitution was supposed to be ratified. But then it didn't happen. What happened was immediately we went into war, border war with Ethiopia in 1998. It lasted until 2000. That also took another 20,000 lives from the Eritrean side. So every single family paid a life, including myself, which I paid the life of my father. So in 2001, there was continuous pressure against the president of then, which we never had election, by the way, it's one state party. And the request for election, democracy, constitution, this was continuously rejected. In fact, anyone who tried to raise those questions were imprisoned. So today we have several ministers who fought all these years in the time of independence in prison. The media was shut down in 2001 as well. We had an extensive number of private medias. And then what the current government brought was that a national service as a means of trying to rebuild the country. We were all happy with it in the first place, which it was started in 1994, 95. Everybody, some people actually went voluntarily. Some people knew that it's not going to escape them, so they go. But this indefinite national service eventually, the national service eventually became indefinite mandatory national service. And this is where the whole issue started.
Forced physical labor. Is that right?
It eventually turns out its first 6 months military training is supposed to be another 18 months of national service. Then it become indefinite. And within that period, what you do is forced labor. There were people who worked under the mining companies as of 2010. Those companies are, by the way, foreign companies like Canadian, South African, Chinese, Australian. But the indefinite national service kind of curtailed people from living their own life. You cannot personally have your own life. You cannot deal with the day-to-day life. You are part of the army for almost the entire year, with the except of maybe another 15 days of that year. You don't get paid. Maybe you get paid less than $15 a month, and with that amount of money, you cannot even pay rent. So eventually, you become property of the government. And this actually catched me up. Although I was born in 1986, you become 18, you have to go to the national service, and you become eventually as part of the government's policy. And this applies to male and female. So we knew what's ahead of us. I actually served in the military training and then part of the national service. But you see nothing ahead of you. There isn't any hope. Then you are forced to flee. And within that, also within that military training and national service, there is continuous beating up, because you cannot raise any voice. Yeah, there has been extensive torture.
And you were a victim of torture?
Yes, I was. It did happen when I was at the military training camp, and this happens even in prisons. And it gets to a point that I could not control it anymore. I just couldn't live that kind of life anymore. So without knowing what to expect next, me and my fellow friends, I had like other five friends with me, we flew from the military training camp to a neighboring country, to Sudan. From Sudan, then you start asking yourself, what next? What do I do? I'm here. And safety was not good enough in Sudan either. So I had the ambition of wanting to continue my education. And then I had an uncle who was studying in South Africa. He suggested I come study in South Africa. So through paying smugglers, I managed to land to South Africa, and I did my BA in engineering in South Africa. But during that period also, a lot of my friends were filling the country. And in that process, many of them actually drowned in the Mediterranean Sea, where you see the famous boat people, and also some of them in the Sinai Peninsula, where extensive human trafficking took place. And that kind of forced me to do something about it, because I couldn't live a normal life. On social media, you get to see one of your friends' picture and identity, people asking if you know his existence. Those were repeatedly happening, and several documents were also made by Al Jazeera and all the networks on the horrific events that were taking place across the Sinai Peninsula. And those are Eritreans, majority of them, and few South Sudanese trying to make their way to Israel, looking for safety. And that kind of forced me to do something about it, because I couldn't just live a normal life. I've seen so many of my close friends died. I had a chat, or I make a phone call back home, and the next thing you hear is, you know, so-and-so and so. Yeah, and they tell you he died in this place. Trying to flee the country, either on the border. By the way, in 2005, when I flee the country, there was a shoot-to-kill policy by the Eritrean government. And this kind of forced me to do something about it, which I started advocating against the human rights violation in Eritrea. There was an organization started by the previous students in South Africa called Eritrean Movement for Democracy and Human Rights. So I was covering the western region of South Africa for them. And also, I co-founded an organization called Unity for Tertiary Refugee Students. So what we do is we try to educate refugee by looking for scholarships at a university level so that they become advocates of themselves rather than UNHCR or somebody else advocating on their behalf. So that brought me to come to the United States to speak about human rights violation in Eritrea and the plight of refugee, and what is it like to be a refugee, to speak at some international summit. I should mention, in South Africa during that period when I was there between 2006 and 2012, there was several horrific incidents that refugee faced, like the xenophobia in 2008, in which nearly 70 African refugees were horrifically killed, some of them even burned. And hence, South Africa wasn't even safe for me as a refugee. So that as for many other refugees from Africa, like from Nigeria, from Somalia, and other parts of Africa. And those things still happen to date. The latest one was 2 years ago, when the tribal king said, we don't need immigrants in this country. And then about 8 people were killed in less than 2 days. So I came to the United States as a result of advocating at some international summit. And when I got here, I had to think about my life twice. What do I do? Do I go back to South Africa, which is not very safe? Or do I apply asylum here and carry on with life and do on the work that I was doing? And the best choice was for me to apply asylum here, which I applied at the San Francisco Asylum Office. So there is a battle of getting granted for asylum. It took me a year. But finally, they granted me asylum here in the United States. Now I live in Auckland, and I'm very grateful that I've been living in this country for the last 4 years. And I continue to do the work that I was doing on advocacy.
Amazing. Benjamin, you wanted to weigh in? Go ahead.
Well, so Mehran's story is very important because it illustrates three big dimensions to refugee and asylum processes. The first is, compared to the earlier stories we heard of people who were living in camps and then were resettled through UNHCR, Mehran's story is that of personally fleeing and smuggling himself out of a space in order to get protection. So the vast majority of people are not formally resettled by the UNHCR. The vast majority of people who are fleeing countries because of war or conflict or famine or flood are themselves entirely dependent on themselves and their families for help. So Mehran has paid people. He also helped his brothers flee subsequently. The second thing that it illustrates is that the country where you go temporarily, maybe thinking it's going to be a safe place, is not always that case. South Africa actually has more asylum seekers than anywhere in the world. And that's pretty remarkable, but sort of statistic. But it's not a safe place for asylum seekers. Many people, their asylum cases are languishing for more than a decade. Many don't even know if it's actually a real form that they submitted or a fake one that they paid for, because there's so much corruption and bribery in the asylum process. And there's also incredible xenophobia and violent xenophobic violence in South Africa, particularly in 2008. When dozens and dozens of immigrants from Congo, from Eritrea, Somalia were murdered by other South Africans. So the first place that someone goes to is not often the safest place. And a lot of Americans want to know, why do you come here and not stay in Thailand, for example? Well, Thailand is not going to allow Hmong to settle there. Thailand doesn't want Hmong there. Thailand wants to be rid of him and all the other refugees. South Africa doesn't want all these people there. And government doesn't stop forces mobilizing to get rid of immigrants. And then the third thing that's important about Mehran's story is that he talks about asylum. And what he did was he arrives in the U.S. on a legal visa as a visitor, and then he has to face the situation, do I return? But instead he filed for asylum. So there's the distinction between the refugees like Hmong and any who are part of a formal process that are being brought over here and resettled, and those are the people who come to Rochester routinely over the course of the year. And then there are people who are here temporarily, maybe as a student, maybe as a visitor, maybe on business. Something happens in their country between arriving, or it's already taking place, and then they file for asylum. And then they go into administrative process where they seek that process to have protection granted.
All right, I'm going to sneak in a phone call here, and we got to keep it tight because we're going to lose the hour. But Robert in Canandaigua, Robert Bilheimer on the line with us, who's a filmmaker who's done work on the dangers of human trafficking. Go ahead, Robert.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
Good.
Well, listen, I'll make this quick. What a wonderful show. Thanks to you and all of your panelists. Just very valuable. I just wanted to mention very quickly that you know, we're working in Europe now on the vulnerability of migrants and refugees to human traffickers. And I just got back in September where I did a shoot in the notorious jungle refugee camp that's now been dismantled. And I just feel it's really important for folks to know on the vulnerability side of this issue how astonishingly difficult and dangerous right now the situation is in Europe, because human traffickers are really kind of holding sway now at this point. There are 30,000 of them operating freely throughout the continent, often in concert with the mafia. And the situation for children is particularly desperate, and it represents, in my view, a real failure throughout the EU to deal with this in any kind of a meaningful way. So here's yet another dimension to the problem that people don't often think about, but it's very real. And I just wanted to take a minute to slip that in, and I will get off the air. But thanks.
Robert, thank you, and I look forward to future conversations. Benjamin, you want to respond?
Well, trafficking, which is some of the narrative of Mehran and others, is a big component to the forced movement and migration of people today, refugees. Many are so desperate that they put their trust in other people, either pay for them or they ask for help from other people, and they are experiencing horrific violence in that process. So Mehran today is going to talk a little bit about what happened to so many Eritreans who chose to try to move through the Sinai Peninsula and the horrific torture camps where people were kept in prison, their families were contacted and extorted for money, but then they were still killed. We know similar stories happened to Ethiopians fleeing the dictatorship in parts of Ethiopia, going through Djibouti into Yemen. The stories of people being kept in holding cells while their families are extorted and they're tortured with live video feeds are very well documented. And then, of course, we have to think about the thousands of people who are making the voyage across the Mediterranean on on inflatable dinghies and rafts. At least 3,000 Eritreans have drowned this year alone. That's how desperate people are. I mean, people don't leave their homes if they're happy and are doing fine. Most people want to live in their home, live in their village, live in the town where they were born, among people that they know. The vast majority of people don't want to leave.
Well, I think you've heard this hour. Our three remarkable stories, and I want to thank all of our guests, Marin Semidar, Maung Thet Win, Annie Jabril, who are refugees, and as I said before, I think making this country better and making this experience so much richer. Thank you for sharing your experience with us, to all of you. Benjamin Lawrence and Mike Kniff, thank you to both of you as well for the work that you do and for your help putting this together. And again, you can hear more from Marin on the subject, Let's Bring Back Torture or Worse, the perspective of someone who lived in a nation where it was policy, who experienced it himself, and then to hear an American leader talk about that. That's the 3:30 this afternoon in the Carlson Auditorium at RIT. It's open to the public. Let's get a short break and more connections.